So, Mr. President, I forgot today to say that there will be a Washington seminar, so I thought I'd throw that in. Let people know it's going to be in late January. The Great Gathering In meeting is on the 28th of January. So all of you who are coming, you will want to keep in mind that the Gathering In meeting, which is on Monday night before we go on to the Hill on Tuesday, is on the 28th. So you want to be there. The rooms are a little expensive, but that's the way Washington is. So when you want to change the government of the United States, you have to go there. And you can be glad that it's not some of the high-priced hotels. A certain hotel operator, well, he's taken up residence in the White House, and he's got some very expensive properties there. So, you know, keep in mind you want to go to the sort of expensive place that we're going to be operating out of, which is a Holiday Inn. So that's that, Mr. President, unless you got... All right, great. Now, you know, I've been in this federation for quite a while. I came to my first convention in 1969, which was a national convention we held in Columbia, South Carolina, and I think it's the only one we've ever had there. And we stayed at the Wade Hampton Hotel. Some of you will know that Wade Hampton was a general in the Confederate States of America Army, which means he lost. But it took him a long time to figure this out. And so they had a hotel named after him, but the hotel has now been torn down. So you can't go back and see the place where we held the 1969 convention. Now you can go and you can see the place where we held the 1940 convention. It's been remodeled, so it's not the same hotel, but it's still on the same piece of property. And you can go look at that one. And I don't know whether you can go to Kokomo to look at the very hotel where we held our first convention. Do you know, Pam? No, you don't know. Well, now John Jansen, who was our first president in this state, I knew John Jansen. I knew John Jansen. He was in the South Bend chapter when I was there, and he was maybe the oldest guy in the chapter. And he would make a speech every meeting, and he would say, "We got to put our shoulder to the wheel, and we've got to get busy, and we got to work on this federation. We got to put our shoulder to the wheel." And I like that guy. You know, he'd been, I guess, some kind of a machine operator, and he was from Hungary, and he had come to the United States because he was looking for a future, and he didn't know what kind of a future he could get, and he was a blind person, and he didn't know how to build a different kind of life in the United States very well as a blind person, but he believed that there was a way we could do it. And so there he was, and I was so impressed with him as the kind of leader we had that I think I was the one who helped to cause the John Jansen Award to be created, and I never knew he was our first president. So I learned that today. And it's glorious to be here with you to find out that this fellow that impressed me so much when I was 19 years old in college in South Bend, and I came to the chapter meeting because when I went to the college campus, I had been in the Federation for over a year, and I got onto the campus and found out that I was alone. I was all by myself because those guys didn't expect much of blind people. They said I was very brave. And I thought, well, yeah, maybe it is brave to go to this college. I don't know. But they meant brave of a kind that the other people in that college were not brave. So, you know, they thought I was different from everybody else and especially brave. And I thought, yeah, but not like that. And then I thought, I need somebody else. So I went down and I joined the local chapter. Now, the local chapter was 20 people. And I was talking to Kane Brolin the other day, and he said it's usually about 15 these days. And I thought, well, it's about the same size it used to be. And it was bigger in between, at least part of the time. And I gather it was littler in between part of the time. So they come and they go. You build them, and then you got to keep building them. They don't stay all by themselves. You got to put energy and resource into them. But I thought, I knew a lot more about the Federation than these people in the South Bend chapter, and they'd been there longer than I had. And they thought I was an upstart and a whippersnapper and a kind of an obnoxious so-and-so just to know it all. They're probably right. But I needed them, because when I got onto the campus, we worked on things together, some of us on the campus. You know, we worked on mathematics and philosophy. I was studying engineering, as I told some of you at the time. And I was going to the chemistry class and finding out how tricky chemistry can be if you do it at the college level. I met the guy who was at the college level teaching that particular class when I went back to get an honorary degree in 2010, you know? And he said to me, why weren't you a chemist? You'd have been a good chemist. And perhaps he was right. But I thought, I got busy working on something else. And I'm not sorry. No matter how good the chemistry might have been, some of the stuff we've done together has been better. And so I was on the campus and we worked on some of these things, but they didn't understand what my life could be. They wrote me off beforehand, except a few, very few people, like that chemistry professor. He didn't write me off. But a lot of them did, including a bunch of the professors there. And so I thought, if we're going to change this society, we have to have friends, and I have to have friends, and I need you guys, even if I knew no more about the philosophy of the Federation than you do, and even if I do have experience of people who are in it who have professions that you don't, and even and even and even and even. And besides, there was that guy named John Jansen, and he believed that if we worked together, we could change things. And whether he had the kind of education that I was trying to get, or the background, or whatever it was, he believed before I ever got there, and he kept on believing just as hard and just as long as he lived and breathed his last breath. So I found out some things about the Federation in the state of Indiana. And you know, some of what happens when I come to Indiana is reminiscence. You may have noticed this. But a lot of it has to do with what my current thinking is. A lot of it was formed by the experiences I had in this state. Some of it was formed before I got here, which is how I got to be thought of as a know-it-all. But some of it happened right here. I was in a program to teach you how to be a blind person before I came. Dr. Jernigan was running this program. And we thought about very important things in that program, like how do we go find a job, and how do we know what kind of a job we can do, and how do we think up ways of approach to the society that will let us get into the places where we want to be. And you start by thinking you ought to be there. You start by saying, there's a place for me there. Maybe they don't know it, but I know it, and I want to be there, and I know once they know how important my place is there, they'll want to have me be there too. You got to think that, and you can't just imagine it. You have to really think it, and then once you think it, you have to go pursue it, and you got to believe yourself. Now, do you always believe yourself? No, sometimes you doubt. Sometimes you think, am I just blowing smoke here again? But you got to believe in yourself. You got to start there, because other people won't believe in you until you believe in yourself. And the trouble is, until you do something that makes you think, yes, I can do this, then you don't know if you should believe in yourself or not. But you got to convince other people that you're believing in yourself, even when you don't know whether you're believing in yourself. So, we used to sit around together at night, you know, and think what the differences are between blind people and sighted people. And we said, you know, well, blind people are blind, of course, and how does that change us from other blind people, from other people? And then we would say the important questions of the day, especially for people who were, say, 18 years old, like me, like, who do blind people marry? Now, you may not have thought of this, But it's a quite an interesting question. And it's not just interesting for people who are 18. You know, some people get really interested in this after they're 18, and sometimes when they even get up to 30 or 40 or something like that, they still start thinking about, I'm a blind person. I wonder who blind people marry. And this is, you know, quite a fascinating topic. So, blind people, of course, marry sighted people. Because, you see, if you have two blind people in a family, it's dangerous, isn't it? Because, you know, it's okay for one blind person, but you don't want to build up on the blindness too much. If you have too many blind people trying to do things in the same place, it's dangerous, isn't it? So blind people, they mostly marry sighted people. Mm-hmm. Why? You mean you don't trust blind people? Is that what it's all about? You want to go marry sighted people because blind people aren't worthy or trustworthy, or what is it? Now you see, you might not think these conversations occurred, but they did. And you might not think that we were that honest with each other. We might have all lied about it, but we didn't, not all the time. How much of a disadvantage is it if a blind person marries another blind person? Because, you know, they're blind. That means they're limited. That means you're adding limitation to limitation. How are you going to get away with that? Is there any advantage at all to a blind person marrying a blind person? Really? How do you figure that out? I know, I heard you over there saying, well, yeah, they can't see each other, they can't figure out how they look, you know, and you can get away with a lot there, you know. That's sure. Not so much. Ron Brown over here, he worked this out. He decided to talk to this lady, and he got a signal together. What was it, your brother or somebody? You worked it out with your brother to find out what she looked like. And he said, if she's looking pretty good, you know, you can tell me by the weather report. So if the sun is shining, it's really nice and bright out there, you can say the weather's pretty good, and then I'll know. And so they got over there, and he said, well, sun's shining. He said, weather's pretty good. He said, I'm telling you, I mean, not the sun's not shining. It's just, the sun is shining. and consequently, there are other ways to know, you know. You can get your hands on the person. And, you know, blindness does let you do that some. Although it happens with sighted people, too, I found this out. But he found out that the sun was really shining that day, so he got the details, and he used a ruse to find out. But he learned. Now, we did this because we wanted to know. And later, I found out that parents are very worried about this. Now, I'd never talked about this with my parents, so I didn't know, and I don't know today, because I never mentioned it to them, and they never mentioned it to me. I don't know what they thought about who blind people marry, especially me. I'm sure it crossed their mind, because whenever I think about my children, I wonder who they are going to marry, and so far, they haven't given a great indication. So I know my parents worried about this. They thought about it. They wondered. And I learned later that they also want to know how blind people date. Well, it had crossed my mind to wonder this myself. Who is it that blind people date? I've discovered the answer to that question. You know who blind people date? Whoever's nearby. And so there was a parents program later. We put the parents division together in the early 1980s. And the parents came by and they said to me, now, you seem to be married. And I said, yeah. And they said, did you date? And I said, yeah. And they said, how'd you do it? I said, well, the way people usually do it, I guess. I don't know. What do you mean, how did I do it? They said, we want you to come and be on a panel to tell parents how blind people date. Okay. I'm going to get Ron to do it next time. He has more. He's got more stories than I have. I'm not sure he wants to tell them all now, but he seems to have more than I have. So we'll find a way to tell the blind parents, don't worry about it too much. Maybe sighted people don't know how to date either. And you find out by going out there and giving it a try. And you learn things as you go along. And somehow or another, especially in places like locker rooms and so forth, people do talk it over. And then you learn some things that are true. And you get told stories and you think that can't possibly be true and like that. But you practice on these very important questions. And then you wonder, what else is different about blind people than is true of sighted people? So people ask lots of questions. Are blind people fatter than sighted people? Well, there are lots of folks who say that blind people are fatter than sighted people. And then they tell you why. They say, well, you see, blind people sit around more. All right, so Ron, are you fatter than sighted people? You sit around a lot, then? Well, some blind people, when I asked that question, I did this at the national convention one time, and some of the blind people in the room who were a little heavier than some other, they wondered, are you attacking me? The answer is, no, I'm not attacking you. This is just what we asked each other. So are blind people skinnier than sighted people? Well, there's a story that went around when I was in college which said that part of the experience of your olfactory and your taste buds was visual. This was the story. And they said, so for example, blind people don't smoke because some of the interesting experience of smoking is watching the smoke rings rise. And blind people never see that, so they don't smoke. And and they said, part of the experience of eating is looking at the beautiful arrangement of the food. And so blind people, they never have that experience. And that means they're less interested in food than sighted people. And so they're skinnier than sighted people. Well, these stories go around. And then there was the story that blind people have better sniffers than sighted people, have a better sense of smell because they, you know, their minds aren't taken up with seeing. So their minds are used for other things and they can smell things better than sighted people can. And so there ought to be a profession for blind people to be perfume sniffers to determine which perfumes are the best and so we can sell them. This is one of the advantages of being a blind person. It's not a profession I've ever wanted to be in. But and I've never figured out that where to apply even if I had wanted to be in. But that was the story. And after a while you get the idea that there are differences perhaps between blind people and sighted people, but nobody knows precisely what they are. Not even us. And we live this all the time. So we stopped speculating about, or at least mostly, stopped speculating about how blind people are different from sighted people. And we started thinking that what we ought to do is pass the word that our talents are about the same as those of everybody else. And we thought that this would be a very important thing to do. Except we did ask questions like, what are the professions that blind people cannot be in? And we identified that we couldn't drive an automobile, and we couldn't fly a plane, and we couldn't be doctors. We said these things. Now, of course, there are blind doctors. We've helped to train some of them since, and we've helped to keep some of them in the profession who became blind after they became doctors, and whose patients wanted them very much to stay a part of the practice, and we kept them in the practice. Especially, I remember a guy in Louisiana, he'd lost his sight, and his patient said, don't stop doctoring, you know, you've been doing so well for us. And the medical board was going to throw him out, and we protected the doctor from being discharged. So I know there are doctors. And then, you know, we talked today about this driving business, and we got to thinking that it isn't all that complicated. And so we built the thing, and we got that taken care of. And then the question about this airplane, I really would like to try that. I met a guy one time who said he was flying a plane. You know, he's a blind guy. He was a pilot. He was from England. And he came to the National Convention, and he told us his story about being a pilot and how when he started the engine in his plane, all the people around scattered in all directions and so forth. And had a great time telling these stories. And I got to thinking to myself, I wonder if this guy's really true. And so I went to England to find out. And every time I wanted to go down and see him fly his plane, the weather was wrong. And the every time, and the weather was wrong, and then I would set up another day, and the weather would be wrong, and I'd set up another day, and the weather would be wrong. And after a while, I got to thinking, there's never going to be the right weather for this guy to show me, and I was never able to verify that he knew how to do it, and as a matter of fact, I have considerable doubt. So it's a thing for us to do yet, I think. And I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to figure out how to do it. So the other day, I was talking to a pilot who got to be a friend, and I said that I wanted to learn how to fly, and he said, you know, you figure out where we're going, and why don't you leave the flying to me? And I thought, I guess I'm not going to train you, and I guess you're not going to train me. I'm going to have to get somebody who knows more about blindness than you do and who has more faith and who's willing to do more experiment. But I think this is possible to build a system where we can be in the sky as well as anybody else. And I've met the head of NASA who said the time when blind people can train to become astronauts is now. He said, we've passed the time when the idea that you have to have good sight is an essential for becoming an astronaut. So where are the professions that the blind cannot do? I really don't know the answer to that question. I know a lot of professions that blind people can do, and I've helped to think up ways for blind people to do things that they never thought they could do, but I'm not sure I know what the edge is where we're prohibited from joining any profession. And that is what I've learned starting in one state, the state of Iowa, moving on here to Indiana, and going on from there. So I've been wondering how we have to proceed in the future and where we are expected to go and what we're going to do and how we're going to manage the differences. Now, when we were talking about who blind people marry a while back, in those days, the idea was that those of us who are men would marry women. And those who were women would marry men, and that's the way it would be. I've noticed that there are other choices now. And so, as we start thinking about the future, we have to incorporate the new choices, and it is a slightly more complicated system than it was in the past. And I am not tempted to pursue some of the choices that I've heard are available. But I'm fascinated by the conversation. And I believe that the spirit of joy that comes from human relationships is worth pursuing. And I find that there are thoughts about it that have never occurred to me. And from time to time, I think, how does this work into the realm of blindness where I live so much and so often, and I'm not sure I know the answer about that question, but I'm sure many of my colleagues in the National Federation of the Blind will fill me in. I have faith in my colleagues in the National Federation of the Blind. And when I approach the subject of the future, and this includes my future as well as your future, meaning our future, I think about this organization and I think, what do I want from the National Federation of the Blind? I've lived in it a long time and I've had many of the experiences that you know about, and I have a spouse that came into the National Federation of the Blind before I did and has been a partner in our family and in my work and in her work in the Federation for all this time. And I've told you some of the stories that come from the relationship that we have. You know, I guess I talked about this a little bit on the television program the other day, but we had a small son, David, in 1984. So that does indicate that he is 34, although I expressed a different viewpoint on the television show. Patricia Maurer corrected me. And so he weighed about 3.5 pounds, okay? And they said to us, you know, we don't know how you're going to care for him. They kept him in the hospital because he had some breathing problems and some jaundice and things like that. So he was there for a month, and I kept visiting him in the hospital, and I would work during the day, and I would visit during the evening, and I would spend time with him. And then he grew a little, and we got him so that he was ready to be released. And they said, we don't know how you can take care of him. They said, he's subject to sudden infant death syndrome. Now, I don't know what the situation about that is today, but in those days, they said the characteristics of this child are that he is fragile and he might stop breathing or his heart might stop at any time, and you have to know when this happens, because if you don't, in about 4 or 5 minutes, it's over. And there's no indicator. There's no way to tell when it's going to happen. They said, what you do to prevent this is you get a monitor, and you have this child wear the monitor, and it consists of a belt that goes around him, and there are places to attach cords onto the belt, and these cords go to a box, and the box monitors the breathing and the heart rate, and if the heart rate goes to zero, if it stops, or if the breathing stops, then the monitor makes a noise. And you can't read the monitor, and we don't know how you're going to do this. And we said, yeah, but the monitor makes a noise. And they said, yes, but maybe there's something you should know on the readout of the monitor. And we thought, the noise is enough. And so we had a conversation, and they said, we'll teach you what to do. And they gave us lessons about our son and what happened in case his heart stopped or his breathing stopped. And they rented us this monitor. And they rented us the box, and they rented us the extra battery, and they told us if we plugged it in, then it would charge the battery, and how long it took to charge the battery, and how to put it on the child, and things like that. And they said, and if the battery, I mean, if the monitor goes off, then you go through these various procedures to get the heart started and to get the breathing started. Okay. And they gave us 4 classes on how to do it. And then they said, but we still don't know. And we said, we'll take him. And we went home with him. Incidentally, they had a bill for us when we left, and it was several thousand dollars. And I said, this is your bill, to David. And I gave it to him, and he dropped it on the floor. So I guess I had to pay it. And we were joyful, and we took him home. And that began the tiredest period of my life, when I worked all day and stayed up most of the night to take care of this child and feed him now and then when his mother wasn't feeding him, which she did a bunch of the time, and to walk him around because he was fussy, and so he would cry, and I would pick him up and think, I'll just sit down here in the rocker with you and rock a little, and he wouldn't let me do that. He said, you got to walk around. And he said, get up and start walking around because, you know, you're my dad, and your obligation is to keep me from crying all the time, and you got to walk me around. Mm-hmm. How about if we just sit down a while? No, no. So he was in charge, and I could sleep anywhere. If I was riding up in an elevator to the 20th floor, I'd have a nap in the corner. You know, I didn't care where it was. Now, we had him about a week, maybe a week and a half, and suddenly the alarm went off. And I ran over to the bassinet, and I got a hold of him, and I found, oh, the wire had come loose. He'd rolled over a little bit. He wasn't good at this rolling over yet because he was so little, but he'd rolled enough, and the wire had come loose. And I thought, all right, and I put the wire back on. The machine went quiet, and I thought, good. So this happened a lot. Every 3 or 4 days, the thing would shriek and the wire would be off, and I would put it on, and that would be that. Except, of course, one Saturday night or Sunday morning, depending on how you look at it, when we'd been out welcoming some Federation group or other and having a small party, and we got home about, say, midnight, and we took over, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, the thing started howling, and I thought, all right, I'll get the wire. And I went over to the bassinet, and I picked them up, and they were all tight. Not a thing wrong with the machine. And I thought, what do I do now? And I found out. The first thing they said to do is take the baby and shake him, because this will stimulate him and he might stop crying. And it might get his heart started and his breathing started if they weren't. And I took him and I shook him and he said, "Ah!" And I thought, great, keep that up. You can't do that without breathing. And we solved that problem. It only happened once. Now the interesting thing, at least for me, is that a couple of years later, it was a Friday night late, and this is the day when you used to actually be able to answer the phone. We have a new system now so that it goes someplace where I don't know how to get it in the middle of the night, but I was late at my desk, and it was on a Friday, and it was probably about 8 o'clock, and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and there was a lady on the other end, and she was a new mother, and she had this preemie baby, and they said he might be subject to sudden infant death syndrome. And I thought, I know who you can talk to. I know somebody who knows what the thing is, and I know how to give you encouragement. And so I sent this message over to Patricia Maurer, who happened to be in the office at the time. And she took it and talked to the mom and told the mom how to manage a newborn babe. And a year later, the babe was doing well. So we helped somebody keep the family together. Now, I think back upon these experiences, and they have shaped me. I didn't know how two blind parents working together could raise a family, because I'd met some parents who were blind, but I'd never tried it, so I didn't know for sure. I had the faith from the Federation that it could be done, but I didn't know how to do it. And so when things came up, I would ask around to see who knew. And I would try to find somebody who had experience, but there weren't very many. When I joined the Federation, you would go to the convention, as I did in 1969, and there were no kids. There just weren't any there. Now, we had a parents' division that we started in the 1980s, and there got to be a lot more kids. And then blind parents started having kids, and they would bring them too. But blind people didn't have very many children when I joined. There were some, but not many. And so when I think about what our organization is and think about my own background in it and wonder what the future is going to be, I think to myself, how do we want it to grow? How do we want it to change? And I think, the only thing that I know how to do to make the future better than the past is to change something about what we do, what we want, what we believe in, and how we're going to go forward. Change something. And then I think, what is it that I want to change? And so I start imagining. I want access to things. I want access to information. I want to be able to get at all the information that other people take for granted. All you have to do is look it up. Well, I want to be able to look it up too. And I want access to transportation. How do people get around? Well, some of them ride on the bus, and some of them ride on the train, and some of them ride on the plane, and some of them have an automobile. Well, I ride on some of the trains and the buses and the planes, but I want an automobile too. And I want to be able to operate this thing, and I want to be able to get on the train and know when the train's going to be there and find out where the train's going to go and figure out how to get my ticket from the train and find out what the train schedule's going to be, just like other people. And I want access to all this transportation, all of it, not just some, not just now and then. And then I want to have access, what, to education. I want to be able to get the books. I want to be able to walk on the college campuses and find out what's going on. And I want to know how I can do my work and find out what the details are of the study that I'm supposed to do. I want access to education. I think to myself, I want access, and I want access to employment. I know that I can do these jobs that other people do. I don't want to just do the ones that are set aside for the few people who have these specialized professions in the blindness field or something like that. I want to be able to get into whatever profession I want. I want to find out how to be a broker, or I want to find out, I'm already a lawyer and I want to have access to the information that lawyers have access to them, because a lot of this stuff, even the court system, isn't accessible. And I think to myself, how do you believe that I'm supposed to practice law if I can't get on the court system and find out what documents have been filed lately and what the questions are going to be? I mean, I want access to all this employment, and not just some of it and not just part of the time. And so I start thinking about, what do I want? Am I going to do all these pieces of profession? No, I'm going to pick one or two and concentrate on them. But I want to be able to have the same choices that other people have. And so I think about access, and I want access to shaping the society in which we live. Other people take for granted that you can get together and you can decide that something ought to be different, and that you can talk to people about how it ought to be different. And I want the opportunity to have access to the people who are going to make the future the kind of future we want it to be. And I want access to government. I want to be able to go and be a part of the government and participate in all the elements of the government, and I want access to the information that'll make that practical, and to the systems of participation within it. And then I want access to all the community businesses that we have. So we have all kinds of questions about what can we get and how can we get it. I remember walking into an airport, and I sat down. This was after a long weekend of work at one thing or another. And I sat down, this will surprise you, I'm sure, at a bar. And I thought, I'll order one of these drinks. So I sat there a while, and pretty soon I reached out before me. And lo and behold, there is a tablet. You know what a tablet is? A little piece of technology. Looks a little like an iPad or something. And it's a tablet, but this one wasn't an iPad. And it had a little slot on the side. And I said, a tablet. So I pound on the bar a little bit, and I say, now, hello there, hello, anybody out there? And somebody says, you got to slide your credit card along the side here. I said, what do you mean I got to slide my credit card? I haven't even told anybody what I want. And they said, what you do is you tap on the screen, and the list comes up, and you slide your credit card, and you tap on the drink you want, and then that's what, after a while, it comes. And I thought, I don't want to do this. I want to have access to somebody to talk to. And then I went to the Applebee's store. Have you been to Applebee's? And they've got a tablet. And I'm thinking to myself, pretty soon it doesn't matter where I go, there's going to be some tablet, not a human being. And I do not want to be cut out of the commerce of the country. So I want access to Applebee's and all the other stores and all the other custom that's available to everybody else. And what is it that I'm willing to give up? I don't guess there's much I'm willing to give up. So I start thinking about this, and I think, how do you get this? Well, I only know of one way. If I'm going to get this, I'm going to have to get it by getting together with my friends and making sure that the demand is placed in the right place so that we can get what we have to have, which is to say, the same kind of participation, the same kind of welcome in society that other people have. You know, you and I have a right to dignity in American life and the life of this world, and we have a right to respect for the human beings that we are. And the way that I know of getting it is to join with my friends in the National Federation of the Blind and finding a way to say, no more being cut out. We expect to be part of every element of the society in which we live. And that way, we'll build the future for everybody.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Good job. How about it? Let's give another round of applause, Dr. Maurer. Rousing speech.